Well, thank you all very much for being here. As moderator, I would like to officially declare that all panelists and members of the audience are allowed to have their drinks with them. I'm a law professor here in town at the University of San Diego Law School. Looking at the current financial crisis, it reminds me in some ways of a gigantic accident, so I thought it might be appropriate to begin with the story of an accident. I was struck by this, and so I started to read a fascinating book about big industrial accidents, James Childs' Inviting Disaster. He tells the interesting story. In 1969, the Hungarian Carbonic Acid Processing Company was taking carbon dioxide out of natural gas and selling it, which was their business. They put the liquid CO2 in small cylinders, and if they didn't have enough cylinders, they put them in these big storage tanks. The natural gas came with a certain amount of water dissolved in it, so that would sometimes freeze and cause things like the indicator gauges to stick in place. So at the end of 1968, they shut everything down. The gauges showed they had only 20 tons of liquid CO2 in each tank. On January 1st, they started back to work and directed some of the excess CO2 into storage tank C, which it turned out did not have enough room in it, so it exploded. When storage tank C exploded, it caused storage tank D to explode. When that tank exploded, it took storage tank A off of its foundation and put a little hole in it about this big in the tank. So it then flew across the factory through the wall of the laboratory and dumped several tons of liquid CO2 into the laboratory, instantly reducing the temperature inside to 108 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and coating everything with a thick layer of dry ice. He doesn't say whether the five workers inside survived, but it seems unlikely. So accidents happen, and they frequently comprised of a complex series of unanticipated events. So one may ask, well, what's happened with this financial crisis? Let's go back just a year. August 2007, we noticed that spreads between bank lending rates and the federal government's borrowing rates are widening substantially. This is a danger signal, and it's a traditional measure of financial stress. For small banks, this spread returned to almost normal in the spring of 2008, but by September 2008, the spread for big banks, this is the rate at which the big banks borrowed compared to the rate at which the federal government borrows, had jumped to an alarming level. This is a serious sign of financial stress. Well, why did this happen? Most economists seem to attribute this to a decline in the value of mortgages and of the securities that were claims on mortgages, like mortgage-backed securities, MBSs, and collateralized debt obligations, CDOs. This decline in mortgage values happened both in the U.S. and in the U.K., where there was very little securitization of mortgages. So that suggests that it wasn't securitization that was causing this. Some people, such as one of our panelists, Professor Willis, have been worried about losses from low-quality mortgages since at least 2005. But on August 7, 2007, it became very popular. That's when hedge funds began forced selling of mortgage instruments as lenders began calling their demand loans because they doubted these funds' ability to repay. Now, in normal times, hedge funds and other institutions could just sell assets and use that to meet the demand calls on the money that they had borrowed. But because so many of these assets were being dumped on the market, they were selling at fire sale prices. So this led to deteriorating balance sheets on their part, leading to more demand calls, and then a death spiral in credit markets began. The Fed stepped into this liquidity crisis, if that's really what it was, in late 2007 by vastly increasing its program of lending against non-treasury assets. They ultimately increased their holding of non-treasury assets to where it is now at about $1.7 trillion. Now events seem to accelerate. In March 2008, Bear Stearns faced a run. Now, some experts believe that Bear was solvent at this time if its assets were valued at non-fire sale prices, but many of its liabilities had to be rolled over every day. In March 2008, Bear Stearns lenders balked. They would not roll over their overnight loans, and so the Fed stepped in and for the first time purchased mortgage-backed assets from Bear as part of the deal to fold Bear into J.P. Morgan Chase. Then, in July 2008, IndyMac faced a classic bank run from depositors. FDIC stepped in to make good on deposit insurance at the cost of some $6 billion to the national FISC. So things seemed to calm down for a while. Then, I'm sure you all remember this quite well, in early September 2008, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, whose share price had dwindled, were placed under an awkward federal conservatorship by the Fed and the Treasury Department, which had been facing growing pressure from the investors in Freddie and Fannie, which included both domestic banks and important global banks. A week later, Lehman Brothers found itself, like Bear Stearns, unable to roll over its overnight loans, and this time the Fed did not step in. Lehman declared bankruptcy, and the financial crisis intensified. Almost simultaneously, Merrill Lynch sold itself to Bank of America, and various pundits declared the failure of markets and the end of capitalism as we know it. Almost simultaneously, the giant insurance company AIG faced something like a bank run. AIG had entered into the business of insuring debts in a very big way, especially bonds and MBSs. Debt insurance is like other types of insurance. AIG entered into a contract where it would agree to pay if the borrower defaulted on the loan or if the loan suffered a downgrade in its rating. As markets slumped, MBSs and bonds got downgraded, and AIG ran out of capital to cover its credit swaps. If AIG had defaulted on these insurance policies, the thinking was banks and other financial institutions all over the world would take severe hits on their balance sheets, because they would have to mark down their assets as being no longer insured, and this would greatly exacerbate the crisis. So in an extraordinary move, AIG was effectively nationalized, and the U.S. became the indirect insurer of financial institutions all over the world. As this crisis advanced, it became clear that many financial institutions were not just illiquid, but insolvent. And what that means is that even if you value their assets at non-fire sale prices, their liabilities still exceeded their assets. So Hank Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, decided and carried out an extraordinary meeting with the heads of the top banks in the U.S. to cram down this deal where the Treasury injected directly into the banks capital by buying preferred stock. And then over the last 6 weeks or so, as I'm sure you know, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was originally passed by Congress amid much drama as a means of getting $700 billion worth of troubled assets off the balance sheets of banks, has been transmogrified into an insolvency emergency program, which is injecting capital directly into the banks. Somewhere in the course of all this, we elected a new president. So how did we get into this mess? Well, I'm not sure anyone knows for sure. Here's one story that I've drawn from various people that I respect and seem to know what they're talking about. But going back to 2004 anyway, lenders started to make a lot more risky mortgage loans. Interest rates were low, that's true, but it's not clear that Fed policy was bad. Some say there was a liquidity glut going on, but Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, whom I do not like personally, I'm not his flack in any way, he does make a convenient scapegoat. If the Fed had done something else, we might have had a deflationary spiral back in the early 2000s. Anyway, monetary economists will have to sort that out. One story that I'm sure a lot of you have seen if you read the Wall Street Journal is Peter Wallison's story, and I think there's at least something to it. He, as you probably know, he's a former general counsel to the Treasury department in the Reagan administration and an expert on banking law. Now, he points out, as is quite true, that there's a long history of government policy since the New Deal of encouraging home ownership, creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, tax deductibility of mortgage interest, even second mortgage interest, and so on. Over time, this story goes, for political reasons, there was a push to include more and more financially marginal potential homeowners, potential borrowers as homeowners, to make credit more and more available to financially marginal people. So, for example, the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act requires regulators to press banks to make loans to buyers in low-income and minority neighborhoods. The CRA has come into a lot of criticism as encouraging subprime lending. And there's no doubt that subprime loans have a very high default rate and have something to do causally with this crisis. But it seems to me that the blame here is exaggerated. Only 6% of all subprime loans were extended by CRA-covered lenders to CRA-covered borrowers, and 60% of subprimes went to middle or higher income borrowers in non-CRA-covered neighborhoods. But another part of Wallison's story, it seems to me, rings true. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's mission is to create a secondary market in mortgage loans. In 1992, affordable housing was added to their mission, and they took to it with a passion. You need to recall that they're government-sponsored but privately owned entities, and by buying riskier and riskier loans over time, as they were required to do by HUD regulations, they made a lot of money. Especially after 1997, they started buying more and more non-traditional and subprime loans. From 2005 to 2007, Fannie and Fred bought about $1 trillion in subprime and Alt-A loans, about 40% of their purchases. I think that's an extraordinary figure. And the subprime, Alt-A, and non-traditional loans are where the very high default rates are. Now, and Wallison makes this point, and I think it's a terrific point, which is private entities now were being crowded out by Fannie and Fred, and they fought back. So in 2004, they got Congress to change the tax law to make it much more, much easier, much more efficient to securitize subprime, Alt-A, HELOCs, and other types of non-traditional loans, and made it much, much more tax efficient for hedge funds to buy these mortgage-backed securities and to get very favorable tax treatment. So now you basically have a race between Fannie and Fred and the private label security issuers and buyers to slurp up the bottom of the mortgage barrel, if you can bear with that metaphor, before it was all gone. So the question is, well, why would they do that? Why would they enter into this very risky business? And I think the answer is twofold. On the Fannie and Fred side, well, moral hazard. There's an implicit government guarantee. Nobody really believed that the Fannie and Fred shareholders would be hung out to dry, though to some extent, as we were discussing earlier, they were. So the moral hazard made Fannie and Fred much more likely to go into this risky business. On the private side, it seems that it had something to do with the risk assessment models that were used by the private issuers, using securitization and their view of how they could manage risk. The private issuers, I think, sincerely thought that they weren't taking such extraordinary risks, but in retrospect, it looks like their risk assessment models need to be reassessed. Well, so what should we do from here? I'm at 14 minutes, so, and I'm going to try to hold each of us more or less strictly to 15 minutes. So this is only 60 seconds of what I think should be done. But clearly, it seems to me that with the unprecedented interconnectedness of financial institutions and markets, there's less tolerance for certain kinds of errors, and when accidents happen, they're much bigger. But some suggestions that are floating around out there strike me as very sensible. One is, it seems to me that big financial intermediaries have to maintain bigger capital reserves. There's probably a role for government to require that. Fannie and Freddie have got to make up their minds. They've either got to be completely private or completely public and not this evil hybrid of the two, which they are now. As I already mentioned, I think these risk assessment models have to be reassessed. We have a genuine expert on this quantitative stuff with Andrew here today, so perhaps he can mention that. The incentive structures at these various financial institutions do seem to be skewed towards excessive risk-taking, though I'm very skeptical that there's any kind of regulation that wouldn't just make it worse, but perhaps private institutions will change their models. An idea that is out there is some sort of government support for residential real estate prices. Again, I'm very skeptical of this, but I think there's a lot of political pressure for it, so it probably needs to be discussed. So just to end on a sort of gloomy note, Nouriel Roubouni, who's one of the doomsayers who called this, of course, he's been calling doom for many years, so it's hard to know if he's just the broken clock that's being right. But in an essay he reached in the last few days called Warning, More Doom Ahead, he points out that the sort of crisis we're focused on in the mortgage market, he says anyway, is going on in asset classes across the board. So it's possible that we're going to be looking at bursting asset bubbles, not just in the subprime market, but in lots of other financial assets. There's certainly more to be said, and that's why we have this distinguished panel here today. I'm just going to follow the arbitrary order that's set out here on the table, and we do have a distinguished panel. The first person on our list is Mr. Andrew Redleaf, who probably qualifies as the smartest and richest person in the room. So he gets to go first. He in 3 years, he got both his BA and MA in mathematics, magna cum laude from Yale University, and like any sensible person, decided to go directly into options trading. He went to Gruntal Securities, and after only 2 years, secured an independent seat on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange as a market maker. In 1995, he helped launch a family of hedge funds, and then again in 1999, launched his own family of hedge funds under his direct leadership, and he's the founder and CEO of White Box Advisors. So I give you Mr. Andrew Redley. And if I could just ask panelists to try to speak directly into their microphones for the benefit of the recorder, and I'll give you a wave when we're coming up on 15 minutes.
That was an excellent summary of a lot of the things that have happened. I don't know, maybe I'll take less than 15 minutes. I'm going to try and tease and titillate you and hope maybe stimulate some questions. One of the things that's sort of universal is because of the timing and so forth. Whenever we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about subprime, and there's some kind of temporal link and maybe a causal link. But to me, the subprime mess and the financial crisis are completely. Two completely separate things. In the first place, we made about $600 million being short subprime mortgages. So that's the exact opposite of a crisis from our point of view. that's money being shifted from people who never should have had it to their rightful owners. In the financial crisis, we've lost about twice that. So that is a genuine crisis. We obviously, kind of anticipated problems in subprime loans. We didn't anticipate the things that happened sort of post September, and it's now my view that while they were unprecedented, they actually properly framed, they don't stand out as the outliers that you might have think that you might think. It's kind of my view that subprime the different subprime vis-a-vis versus the long-term capital meltdown and engineered bailout or the agent contagion before that or not, or Orange County and the, all the sort of market disruptions we've had in the past, all of those sort of resulted in short blips and absence of capital, tighter capital, higher prices for capital, but really some availability and problems quickly reversed by Fed easing. In this circumstance, we've had absolutely unprecedented Fed easing, both on the interest rate front and on the acronym front and the various lending programs. And yet, the sort of typical mid-sized company that you might have heard of or you might not have that has about as much debt as equity, in previous crises, their cost of borrowing in the marketplace went from 400 or 500 basis points over treasuries to 1,000 or 1,200 over treasuries, which would in current times that would relate to the pre-crisis they were borrowing at 7 or 7.5%, post-crisis they could borrow at 12 or 13%. Now they can't borrow, and they're secured if they have existent debt existing in the exigent in the secondary market. It trades with 20 to 30% kind of yields, sort of prices that only a secondary market can pay. No enterprise can pay that. So why this time and not other times? Why did markets kind of recover? Why did they not sort of completely shut down for a very, very wide range of companies in previous crises, and why this time? And I think the answer, which has come to me in the last bunch of weeks, and I wish it came to me in March, is that while the rhetoric has been the same sort of throughout the crisis, which is to say, as a matter of policy, we don't want to pick winners and losers, we don't care about particular institutions, it's not saving this person versus that person. It's saving the it's the financial markets in the abstract, and that and yes, it's a Protestant country, so you have to talk about moral hazard and a little bit, but in fact, the direction really was, while some individual people might have been saved or better off or not, policy was really directed at preserving market functionality, in this instant, it really wasn't. The rhetoric was the same, the policy was the exact opposite. It was to pick a group of winners. It was to sort of circle the wagons around nine selected institutions and actually actively go out and shoot, you know, sort of the players outside of that circle. I think never met him. You know, I think Henry Paulson is probably a pretty smart guy. I think he's, you know, actually sort of doing a good thing, serving the government. But you know, I think he actually believes what's good for Goldman Sachs is good for the country. And if Goldman Sachs and people like Goldman Sachs can be supported and save the markets will work. And you know, one of the first mistake we made from a trading point of view is we didn't lose money on this, but we were sort of set up to make money the other way. I didn't believe that Fannie and Freddie, which I thought were, you know, very possibly insolvent. I didn't believe that their preferred shareholders would be wiped out, obliterated. And, you know, why didn't I believe this? Well, because post bear, it was clear. You know, the Treasury government, with, you know, screaming from the megaphone, tells companies, financial companies, raise equity, raise capital. Recapitalize yourselves. So they do this, and financial companies raised $400 billion in preferred stock between the bear failure in March and the Fannie and Freddie nationalization in September. They raised preferred stock, which was what it really had to be. I mean, it couldn't be equity because everybody understood that equity gets wiped out, that equity holders are at the bottom, and at the very least they're subject to great dilution. So it couldn't be equity. On the other hand, it couldn't really be debt either because companies had too much debt. You know, sort of the only thing it could be is a hybrid kind of middle security. So companies go out and private market response comes up with $400 billion. Fannie and Freddie, Merrill, Lehman, long list of companies. In the meantime, government says, you know, not, you know, companies are solvent. It's their financial statements are good, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, private markets having anteed up $400 billion, the government, as kind of a matter of policy, tears it up. You know, I thought, you know, from the point of view of, you know, abstract things like market confidence and making the market work and encouraging private flow of capital, this was transparently sort of the stupidest thing you could possibly do. I mean, it just made absolutely no sense. You know, I didn't think they were stupid people, so I just couldn't imagine, you know, if they're talking about preserving the markets, that they would do this thing that is absolutely obviously stupid. But you know, I had it framed wrong, in that. The Bush administration is filled with crony capitalists. It's people whose sort of whole worldview is that, you know, business is dealing with your friends, it's social networking, it's who you know. The good people are the good people, and potentially superior, you know, and competitors are sort of, you know, whatever. So, you know, that is their genuine and I believe, you know, sort of sincere worldview. So from that perspective, obviously the Bush administration had no love for Fannie and Freddie. They also had no love for the kinds of people that owned their it wasn't Goldman Sachs, it wasn't J.P. Morgan, it wasn't even Citigroup or Merrill that had huge positions in their preferreds. They had some, but it was other government entities, it was community banks, it was sort of people that they considered unimportant. So of course, from that perspective, toasting them makes perfect sense. They followed it up with a rule prohibiting short selling, for which they would exempt the investment banks. Again, kind of from a market confidence point of view, or what have you, a transparently sort of stupid thing to do. And with predictably sort of stupid results. The stocks became much, much more volatile. Something would open up 15% because there was no one to short it, and it would end up closing down 15% because there were no short people that had people that would have shorted it up 3 or 4% weren't there to buy it back down 3 or 4%. So it made the stock market much more volatile from the point of view of sort of market confidence. A very stupid thing to do. On the other hand, from which market participants do you think are good? Which market participants do you think which ones are your friends? Which ones are competitive nuisances, et cetera? This was a rule change almost explicitly ex post facto to get hedge funds. Let's get the competitors of the investment banks, and so really the entire sort of move from 1,000 over to 22,000 over, the sort of whole financial the financial crisis part of it in my view is the result of crony capitalism within the Bush administration and their sort of policy of supporting their friends and killing the markets but saving institutions.
Sorry.
Yeah. That killed the market, right?
Yeah. Well, that was encouraging. I hope someone tonight will give us something to be happy about, and if not, the bar is still open.
I think my presentation was meant to be incredibly optimistic because it was sort of deliberate policy. It's sort of over.
Yeah. Okay. That's good.
We had a kind of routine crisis. We exacerbated it. It was stupid policy, but.
Okay.
But,
no,
but
actually,
it's probably
I'm
sort
glad,
of coming back.
Okay, that's. I'm glad you said that. Okay. Well, let's. We'll sit. We're going to have plenty of time for Q&A afterwards. So now let me introduce Professor Alan White from Valparaiso University. He joined the School of Law there in the fall of 2007, where he teaches consumer law, commercial law, and contracts. He's a nationally recognized expert on credit regulation and the subprime mortgage market. He currently serves as a member of the Federal Reserve Board's Consumer Advisory Council and was recently elected as a member of the American Law Institute, which for the law professors in the audience will know that's quite a prestigious credential. So, Alan.
Thank you. And thank you to the Federal Society for inviting me to this interesting panel. What I want to talk about tonight is the relationship, the various failures that led to the crisis, and I want to talk a little bit about the failure of legal scholarship, since we're all law professors, many of us, I think, are law professors, and maybe to talk about some of the things that legal scholarship, and particularly law and economics scholarship, ought to focus on in thinking about the crisis and what ought to be done about avoiding this kind of crisis and remediating it in the short term and avoiding it in the long term. So, to me, the crisis, there was an interesting discussion on the listserv that people who teach contracts belong to, and somebody raised the question of whether the crisis reflected a failure of contract, freedom of contract, And I don't know that I would make that general of a statement, but there are clearly three or four contract types that have failed and failed dramatically. And they failed in an environment where contracts were largely deregulated. And they were largely deregulated as a result of an ideology that was fostered in part by, I think, the Legal Academy. And the three particular contracts that I'm interested in are, first of all, what I'll call the non-traditional mortgage, right, at the bottom of the debt pyramid. And by non-traditional mortgage, I refer to what are also sometimes called subprime and Alt-A mortgages, mortgages essentially that didn't qualify to be purchased by government-sponsored entities, mortgages that were priced supposedly according to risk. And I've written a paper called The Case for Banning Subprime Mortgages, which tries to take on the question of the welfare costs and benefits of this particular product during its lifetime in the market. But I think it's pretty clear now that the subprime mortgage and the Alt-A mortgage, in fact, have failed. As of the end of the third quarter, as of the last period for which we have data from the Mortgage Bankers Association, 33% of all subprime mortgages in the country are delinquent or in foreclosure. One out of three are delinquent or in foreclosure. The bond rating agencies are now predicting that when all is said and done, the subprime mortgages that were originated, particularly at the very peak of the bubble in 06 and 07, are going to fail at a greater than a 50% rate. More than half of those loans, subprime loans made in 06 and 07, will end in a completed foreclosure. So that is a contract that has not succeeded very well if more than half of the people failed to meet their obligations under the contract. And there were millions of these, anywhere from 6 to 10 million, depending on how you define prime and subprime. And incidentally, the option arms, the so-called option arms, negatively amortizing mortgages, which are sort of the next wave of the foreclosure crisis, are projected to default at even higher rates, 50, 60, 65%. So it's really an alarming failure when you contemplate it, just as somebody who teaches contracts. I mean, ordinarily, you think of default as an exceptional event, and one for which, of course, we have remedies and legal structures. But part of the problem that we're facing now is that the companies that administer and collect these contracts are faced with levels of default that are completely unprecedented. And the second set of contracts, which relate to that problem, are the pooling and servicing agreements. These are contracts that were used to create arrangements whereby mortgages would be transformed into securities, and the cash flows from mortgages would be sold to various investors in various different ways who would assume various different risks and be compensated in different ways for doing that. And those contracts have turned out to not anticipate very well the huge default event that we're facing right now. And in particular, what I've been writing a couple of papers about lately is this effort to try and get these defaulting mortgage contracts restructured, right? Because one way you can deal with a contract failure is to modify the contract. The difficulty is that the underlying loan contracts, the mortgages with homeowners, are administered by agents who are bound by contracts with their principals, which are these trusts, which in turn represent investors. And those contracts, the pooling and servicing agreements, constrain in a large number of ways the ability of the agent to renegotiate the underlying mortgage contracts. And as a result, we're faced with a situation where a bunch of economically irrational activity is occurring. We have foreclosures now. According to the data that I've been looking at for December, for example, the average loss severity on a subprime or Alt-A foreclosure is between 55 and 60%. That means on the average mortgage, which is about $200,000, the investor is losing $120,000, which is insane. And they're dumping more of these properties onto the real estate market in a depressed real estate market at about the worst possible time to do that. And meanwhile, the restructurings that are being offered to homeowners who are willing to make payments are typically not writing down principal at all. The principal reductions are averaging negative. You know, they're actually capitalizing unpaid payments and increasing people's debt. And this irrational circumstance is happening because, to my mind, at least in part, of a massive failure of these contracts, the pooling and servicing agreements in this case, to anticipate this highly unlikely, I suppose, event of 50%, 60% failure rates of the underlying mortgages. The third set of contracts, which I'm not really going to talk about tonight, I'm very interested in looking at in more detail, are the credit default swaps, which is a form of insurance, as I think somebody mentioned, although it's never been regulated as insurance, and it was insisted quite vehemently that it was not insurance. but these are basically contracts which assured investors that even if the catastrophic event, which has now happened, were to happen, they could be safe and rest assured that they would receive their payment of principal because a AAA-rated institution like AIG would make sure that they got their money. And these contracts have failed for a number of reasons, but so we have these multiple layers of contracts that have completely failed. And what I think a lot of these contracts have in common is that they were designed and engineered in a legal environment which was an environment of deregulation. So if I start at the bottom of the pyramid, when did I start?
You have about 6 minutes, okay. 7 minutes.
With the underlying loan contracts, the mortgages where homeowners borrow money against their home, if we look at the regulatory environment that made the non-traditional mortgage possible, and, you know, non-traditional is a funny description to use in this context because I'm really talking about the mortgage that was created by the federal government, by the Federal Housing Authority Administration and the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 1930s, the 30-year level payment fixed rate amortizing loan. It's only traditional since, you know, the New Deal legislation. Before that, we had 5-year interest-only balloon loans. That was the traditional mortgage. But at any rate, those loans, the ability to do loans that don't fully amortize, that have prepayment penalties, that have all these layers of risk that we now acknowledge have created a lot of problems, that the possibility of making those kinds of loans resulted from legal changes and regulatory changes really starting in 1980. It really goes back to the Reagan Revolution. And actually, it had started gaining some momentum in the Carter administration, so I don't want to blame any particular party. But the Depository Institutions Deregulation of Monetary Control Act of 1980 and subsequently another statute called the Alternative Mortgage Transaction Parity Act were really the culprits of the beginning of a process whereby we decided as a policy matter that it was not important or appropriate to regulate the terms of mortgage contracts and that welfare would be maximized by not regulating. Now, we've seen what that experiment produced, and we had an experiment in deregulating mortgage and consumer credit markets, and it has produced, to my mind, catastrophe. Now, that gets me to sort of my point about the role of scholarship, and particularly law and economics scholarship. I obviously have sort of a partisan viewpoint about this, but I think regardless of your point of view about regulation and deregulation, it's really important and critical for us to draw out the factual experience, the empirical experience of this crisis, and to start thinking about the welfare impacts of regulation and deregulation of credit markets in a more rigorous and thoughtful way. For example, I think it was the case throughout all of the scholarship that was written on regulating not regulating subprime mortgages in the last 10 years, every article I ever read began with this ritual incantation that said that, well, subprime lending is a good thing and it enhances consumer welfare, or claims somewhat akin to that were made, but we have to deal with this little fringe called predatory lending. And we made this distinction. Well, there's subprime lending and there's predatory lending. And the basis for that distinction was never entirely clear to me. And it's the question I pose and try and answer in the case for banning subprime mortgages. And the question really for me is, how do we measure the welfare benefits and also the welfare harms in a utilitarian framework, of course, of particular kinds of credit and particular kinds of credit regulation? And it seems to me that a lot of that scholarship was written on the assumption that more credit is better, And so, for example, there were papers written on the effect of state laws on the supply of mortgage credit. And the presumption was any law that reduced the total volume of lending was a bad thing. Or conversely, any law that permitted the growth of debt and credit was a good thing. Well, to me, credit is not a good in and of itself. It's a means to an end, right? I mean, you can point to welfare benefits of credit. You can say a consumer who's able, for example, to take money that's borrowed and invest it in some higher returning activity than the cost of the money has gained a welfare benefit. They've increased their wealth. You can talk about spreading consumption over time and smoothing consumption over time. I mean, you can think about in a serious and rigorous welfare economic kind of way what consumer credit and mortgage credit does for people and what it doesn't do. But I think scholarship kind of failed to do that. And there was this much too ready willingness to treat the growth of credit as a good thing. And, of course, the credit metastasized. Our level of mortgage debt in the country grew from, I think, something like $6 trillion to $11 trillion in the last 10 years, way beyond the underlying income that people had to support that debt. And so I think we need to think about that a little more carefully and seriously. A couple of other comments about things that scholarship needs to take a little more seriously, besides the general question of the welfare economics of consumer credit regulation. We need credit products that are safe and sustainable. And it has become clear, I think, that the market has not particularly well selected those products. The products that have performed the best, actually, in the current foreclosure crisis are FHA mortgages, which shrank to almost nothing in the market, although now, of course, it's growing quite rapidly because the private label market has self-destructed. But I think there are a lot of important questions about how regulation can make possible and promote sustainable and safe products and discourage, if not completely squelch, risky and overpriced products. We have, of course, our dual banking regulation system, the state and federal combination, and there are very important questions about how that has worked or not worked that we can measure empirically. I think we can also do some good comparative work because the financial crisis, of course, has been worldwide, and there have been mortgage markets that have succeeded or failed to a greater or lesser degree in different parts of the world with different regulatory schemes. And I think there's good empirical work that can be done on that, too. Am I out of time? I think I'm
just about, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll stop there and just say I think there's a lot of good that hopefully we can do by paying close attention to the actual facts of the history that's happening around us.
Thanks, Alan.
Our next speaker is Professor Lauren Willis. She's a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Her scholarship focuses on the intersection of consumer psychology, markets, and the law. She's been writing about troubles in the subprime mortgage market since 2005, which makes her smarter than many of us. Her op-eds have appeared in newspapers across the country, including the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the LA Times. Lauren Willis.
Innovation runs ahead of regulation, and we wouldn't want it any other way. So that is a Secretary Paulson quote. And I think that is a big piece of the problem. Regulation and innovation need to keep up with each other. And so a big piece of this problem, I don't think, has anything to do with which laws were on the book when, but rather with the technology that became available to us when suddenly it became cheap for us to put a lot of data into models and to save a lot of data and then plumb those models to find out exactly how we should price mortgages. And on the other end, of course, the predictions about the performance of those mortgages in pools and the securities. Same technology and it became much cheaper to do that in the mid-1990s. So the beginning of the 1990s sort of was the start of it, but it became much, much cheaper for us to save the information in the mid-1990s. But our system of regulation really ignores that, right? Our system of regulation is at the consumer end, which is what I study, is really focused on disclosure. Disclose information about these loans and let you go out there and pick which one you like. And that works relatively well with certain kinds of market scenarios. For example, one that is not very innovative and isn't changing and isn't coming up with new products, but this market was able to start devising new products and able to start engaging in new predictions. Now, obviously, the models didn't all work so well, but I actually have a fair amount of faith in their ability to work better in the future. So disclosure clearly failed as a regulatory model for the consumer end. A sort of another piece at the consumer end of things would be litigation at the back end. And I think that thus far, everybody in the world has been blamed for this crisis except for the judiciary. So I'd like to, change that and throw them a little blame, too.
Chevron, please.
Using disclosure, why is that not working? Well, we have a market in which offerings change very quickly, difficult for regulators to keep up. Example, option arms. Option arms, in 2003, the head of the OCC was complaining about the fact that here was this product that they didn't understand very well and that was not performing as well as anticipated. In 2005, bond rating agencies were reducing the ratings on option arm securities, and it wasn't until 2007 that a single word about option arms showed up in any of the banking regulatory agency disclosure materials for consumers to explain to them products that they might get on the market. Far too late. So the agencies did not keep up with the innovation. Also, the market can withstand quite risky products. And despite the fact that they haven't done a great job of doing it, they're going to get better at it. Certainly can pool risk and diversify risk in ways that the individual consumer cannot. Right? The individual consumer, you got one house. You don't have a diversified portfolio there. The products. Well, disclosure works relatively well when you have a product that is uniform, right? Yeah, or there's just a few variations out there. But these products have umpteen variations. I was looking at the sheets that they're supposed to start filling out now for the rating agencies about loans within pools. They're supposed to, you know, disclose more information to the rating agencies. And there were 28 different possible X's to put in for what format your prepayment penalty took. On the consumer disclosures, we actually currently kind of punt on this one. You just have to disclose whether your loan may or may not have a prepayment penalty. And, of course, if we had to explain all the 28 possibilities to each consumer, we would have some difficulty doing that. So we have individual products that are varied throughout the market. Also, they are changing. The terms used to describe things change over time quickly. So a consumer may become educated about something, may be able to understand a product, and then they try to advise their neighbor a couple years later. Well, guess what? The products have changed. And so that advice might be very bad advice. There are a lot of attributes that are actually relevant and important. And because they are individualized, you've actually got to understand them. So you need these voluminous disclosures to give information to consumers. You can't use sort of rules of thumb in the same way you might be able to in other areas, or the way you might be able to if the products weren't changing so quickly and weren't so variable. Also, they are malleable over the course of your individual negotiation and getting a mortgage. You may receive information about one product that's being offered to you. Then what's being offered to you may change for very good reasons, right? Something's changed in the market, or something's changed in your financial situation or the broker or lender's understanding of your situation. But it's changing over time. So if you hand people these disclosures, they may be outdated for that very consumer the next day if they're actually being sold a different product. So consumers, of course, also have serious financial knowledge and skill limitations. I think we are all aware of that fairly abysmal situation. And so they tend to make decisions by deferring to the sellers of the product. There's some lulling effect also to some of these disclosures. So on the one hand, we're trying to use disclosure to regulate, but people, when they are given more information, even if they don't understand the information or use the information, believe that they can make a better decision, that they are making better decisions. And there's a certain amount of trust on the part of consumers in the back-end remedy, trust that, well, if I'm being defrauded here, if there's any serious problem, you know, I would be able to sue at the end of the day, and the courts would take care of me, and some trust in the market. They wouldn't be selling this to me if I couldn't afford it. Now, consumer knowledge and skill limitations. Often people just say, well, you know, dumb consumers. They're just stupid. I do want to point out that it's not really an easy decision. It's actually hard to figure out what the right product is for you over your potential future states, right? You've got to predict your future income stream. You've got to predict your future costs. You've got to know what's going to be happening over time, and no one's very good at predicting the future. There also are a fair amount of trade-offs you have to make. You know, when you're making a decision about a mortgage, it's really a decision about your entire financial situation for your family, right? It interacts with the other parts of your financial plan, your retirement, that sort of thing. And so it's really actually not an easy decision. So disclosure really does not work. And this crisis has certainly shown a failure of regulation to keep up with innovation. Is not such a good thing. At the back end, litigation has also been a failure. Consumers, for one thing, are in no condition, financially or psychologically, to litigate by the time problems come home to roost when they have lost the house. And oftentimes they don't know what went wrong, anyhow, because, again, they still have financial knowledge and skill limits, and there's a tendency to blame themselves. Certainly, well, it was disclosed to me. I should have understood it. And also lack of access to legal assistance. These are not people generally who qualify for legal aid. We're not talking about the super poor. Those folks don't have houses. So we're talking about folks who don't have the money for attorneys, but are not destitute. Certainly also a problem is on the litigation side would be the presence of arbitration clauses, not allowing one to go to litigation, and that there's not much money in it for attorneys, and so they don't want to take individual cases. And, of course, attorneys' financial knowledge and skill limits. There's a reason many attorneys went to law school. So that is a problem. Now, what about the judges? Well, just to provide a couple of stories, I was reading a transcript of a bankruptcy case in which someone was trying to save his home, and his testimony to the judge was that he had, in fact, not filled out this application that was being presented as his application for a loan, an application on which it stated that he was earning a substantial salary. In fact, he was out of work at the time, although he did have some income from his wife's work, some small amount of income. But this application claimed that he was earning substantial income. And the judge said, I just don't believe you. No lender would give you a loan if you weren't earning enough money to pay for it. Just inability to believe that that could possibly happen in the world. Judges also, when juries have found Lehman Brothers, for example, complicit in funding predatory mortgages, funding a company that Lehman's in-house folks said, you know, these are the used car salesmen of mortgage loans. You have to put your ethics at the door before you come in, et cetera. So then Lehman, of course, gave them a lot of money and funded their operations. The jury thought, not so good. Well, they got a little $50,000 slap on the wrist for that. You know, if Lehman had been fined $1 million, would have been bad for Lehman in the short run. But maybe Lehman would still be here. And so judges' tendency to simply not believe that this could be happening, instead believing in sort of, you know, your idealized view of what the economy looks like if you've only taken a semester of microeconomics, and so not believing it could be otherwise, more complicated than that, also having financial knowledge and skill limits themselves, and a certain amount of deference to sellers of financial products. Certainly the judges have been passive bystanders in this, and when given the opportunity, have done very little. Until recently, of course. Now that everyone admits there's a problem, judges are being more active. But it's a too little too late, right? It didn't end up having an effect on the market when it might have been able to. So what kind of regulation should we have in a world in which we have innovative, dynamic products, a marketplace that actually can produce some great new products that actually can be very helpful for folks? If people don't really understand them, how do we regulate? Well, one is, before we require a particular disclosure to be given, do real consumer testing to find out if they understand anything on there. I mean, currently we go through sort of this ritual, it's almost religious, right, of giving these disclosures. But nobody reads them, understands them, et cetera. It's this ridiculous sort of ossified form of regulation. If we're going to use disclosure, we've got to do consumer testing. We've got to use disclosures that work. The Federal Reserve just recently did some testing of the one particular form of credit card billing, the double cycle billing. They tried 7 different ways of explaining it to consumers, could not get consumers to understand it in any of those ways. And so now they actually have passed regulation that one cannot engage in double cycle billing. Because they actually tested it. Well, we've got to test things in the real world. Now, there also are going to be situations where we're going to have to ban things like double cycle billing. If people cannot understand what they're getting, we're going to, and we know that these are causing more harm than good, we may have to say that can't be done, or it can't be done for certain kinds of consumers in certain situations. And so real cost-benefit analyses. Also, of course, the community effects of foreclosures now, the effects on neighbors, completely innocent neighbors of foreclosures, is another kind of effect that just regulating it at the consumer, individual consumer side, is not going to affect, right? It's an externality. They're not going to take that into consideration. And so we need sort of a broader view, a more long-term view, and so we need a regulator that really keeps up of innovation and test things on the ground? And does comprehensive cost-benefit analyses taking into account externalities? And I think the only way we can do that is to actually have a federal regulatory agency that has some expertise and some authority in the consumer financial area and has to be independent from the other regulatory functions, has to have the resources to actually be doing high-quality testing, to actually be able to keep up with the market. You've got to have folks really out there in the marketplace and looking at new products with this in mind. And also, I think they need to have fairly broad coverage because products interrelate. And the consumer's financial picture is not just their mortgage or their credit card. It's really a whole package of things. So I am an advocate of that aspect of the Paulson Plan, which was the original Paulson Plan long ago that was talked about in terms of spinning off to have a separate consumer regulator that really can have some expertise in the area.
Thanks, Lauren.
Our next panelist is Professor Arthur Wilmarth, who is a professor at the George Washington University Law School in Washington. He teaches courses there in contract law, banking law, corporate law, and American constitutional history. He's published numerous law review articles and book chapters in the fields of banking law and constitutional history. He received his BA from Yale and his JD from Harvard, and was a partner at the Jones Day and the Barley Snyder firms before he entered the academy. He's argued banking law cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and lower federal courts and testified on banking law issues before the U.S. Senate and U.S. House. Arthur Wilmarth, thanks.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Federal Society for inviting me to participate in this panel. My remarks are going to focus on the role of large financial conglomerates in the subprime crisis, because I see them as the central players in this particular tragedy. Our financial markets have seen really a very remarkable consolidation and convergence between large commercial banks and large securities firms since 1990. We could discuss in detail how that occurred. But effectively by 2007, what you had is a small group of less than 20 what I call universal banks. And by universal banks, I mean what we call financial holding companies that can have a bank, can have a securities affiliate, can have an insurance affiliate. And you also had securities firms, which also had insurance operations and depository institution subsidiaries. And this small group of less than 20 dominated every major sector of the global financial markets, including debt and equity underwriting, syndicated lending, securitization, and over-the-counter derivatives. This group included the four biggest U.S. banks, including Citigroup, which effectively now is a zombie, quasi-nationalized bank, Bank of America, Morgan Chase. We don't know how many troubles they have, but I suspect we're going to hear more. And, of course, Wachovia, which has now disappeared into Wells Fargo. The four largest securities firms, of which Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers failed, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley sort of beat a retreat by turning themselves into bank holding companies so they could get into a tighter embrace with the Fed and the Treasury. And about eight foreign universal banks, of which the biggest three acquired Wall Street firms. Credit Suisse acquired First Boston. Deutsche Bank acquired Bankers Trust, which had previously acquired Alex. Brown, and UBS, which acquired Payne Webber. Then you have some others like Barclays, HSBC, RBS, BNP Paribas, Societe Generale. Well, UBS is a zombie, quasi-nationalized bank now with a huge bailout from Switzerland. Barclays is hanging on by its fingernails, as is HSBC. Royal Bank of Scotland, RBS, has been nationalized effectively by the UK government. So we could say that the track record of this group of giant conglomerates certainly has not been a very happy one, that they are at the heart of this crisis. There were also some significant niche players that were quite large in certain areas, particularly mortgage-related markets like Countrywide disappeared into B of A, essentially a failure. Bear Stearns disappeared into J.P. Morgan. Washington Mutual, the largest failure we've seen among depository institutions, although Wachovia is effectively a failure even bigger. And, of course, AIG, which has been nationalized, which was a big player in credit derivatives. My view is that a Wall Street mentality came to dominate the entire banking industry, and a Wall Street mentality drove the business strategies of these firms. And what do I mean by Wall Street mentality? It's basically it's a securities underwriting mentality. It's a transaction-based, fee-based mentality of, you know, revving up this huge machine of producing financial products and pushing as many products out the door as fast as you can for as many fees as you can, and the devil take the hindmost in terms of long-term consequences. And, of course, people have talked about the kinds of payment incentives where you had these huge bonuses based upon short-term returns, short-term rewards, and no clawbacks. I mean, there was no idea that, you know, if you produced huge returns and got big bonuses and then two years later suddenly there were big losses, there was no clawing back of the bonuses that you had taken. And so the mentality was do the deal now and do it fast. And, of course, if you didn't do the deal, then one of these, you know, 12 to 16 institutions down the street would be doing the deal. Now, this strategy has been called originate to distribute. In other words, you don't keep things on your balance sheet. You don't maintain any monitoring or any watchfulness over what's happening. You just originate it and send it out. You sell it. Actually, as it turned out, what really happened was originate to not really distribute, because, as I'll mention, in many ways these institutions disguised the fact that they were not really distributing the risk, that they were maintaining much of the risk that they supposedly were distributing. Okay, so obviously securitization is a classic example of the originate to distribute, that you originate these loans, or you buy them from someone who originated them, you package them up into a pool, and then with the wonders of structured finance, you split them into tranches, and magically with subprime and option ARM mortgages, which are very highly risky, we've known that for a long time. There were big problems in the 90s with subprime mortgages. Citigroup had problems with them back in the late 80s. But suddenly, magically, with the new structured finance securitization, which strips and tranches, you could take 100% of high-risk mortgages and suddenly end up with 80% of AAA securities being generated by that, 15% of BBBs, and then about 5% of so-called equities or residuals that were unrated. But they didn't stop there. See, Wall Street has a great tradition of taking a potentially good idea and running it and running it and running it until they absolutely destroy it and sort of burn the house down. So they thought, we don't stop there. That's only first-order securitization. Why don't we do second order, which is the so-called credit default obligations, the asset-backed credit default obligations. So you take the 15% of BBBs, which people particularly weren't that anxious for because, you know, they weren't so well rated and their yields weren't that high. The AAAs you could sell out to people who had to invest in AAAs, and the hedge funds wanted the equities and residuals because they were high yielding. But BBBs weren't so popular, so let's put them in a pool into CDOs and then strip and tranche that. So suddenly you can get out of a pool of mainly BBB mezzanine securities on 100% of junk, we can again have 80% AAA tranches in CDOs, and 15% of BBB and 5% of equities. And then some people even thought, well, why stop there? Let's take the mezzanines out of the CDOs and do CDO squared and get 80% AAAs on those. So you had this leveraging and leveraging and leveraging where there was an appearance of AAA based on junk, basically, high-risk securities. Now, obviously, the credit ratings agencies had to be complicit in this. They were bought and paid for just in the same way that Enron and WorldCom bought and paid for Arthur Andersen through massive consulting fees, because, of course, they went to the credit ratings agency and said, well, tell us how we can structure things to get the maximum number of AAAs and the maximum number of BBBs and the fewest number of residual equity unrated stuff. And, of course, we'll pay you, you know, consulting fees to help us. And pretty soon the credit ratings agencies were making more money from this stuff than they were from rating ordinary corporate bonds. So what do we end up with? Well, the numbers are a little bit fuzzy, but it looks like we ended up with $1.5 to $2 trillion of outstanding subprime and all-A mortgages, about three-quarters of those securitized. So maybe $1.2, $1.4 trillion of some kind of subprime all-A mortgage-backed securities. Over $1 trillion of securitized consumer debt, credit cards, student loans, auto loans, a lot of that stuff being quite risky as well. Of course, they didn't stop with consumer debt. They went on to commercial mortgage-backed securities. We now have $800 billion of commercial mortgage-backed securities, and the commercial real estate market, for those who haven't been watching, is imploding. So unfortunately, I have to agree with Professor Rubini that there are more shoes to drop, and the next one is the commercial real estate market. The largest shopping mall owner is about to declare bankruptcy from all appearances. We also had $600 billion of so-called collateralized loan obligations for highly leveraged buyout transactions. There was a private equity boom in taking over large corporations through LBOs. You know, Michael Milken's ghost reappeared. And somehow this was going to be different than it was with Michael Milken and the junk bonds. Well, we now have huge numbers of highly risky collateralized loan obligations, other highly leveraged loans outstanding, and some of these big LBOs are coming unstuck as well. How many of these asset-backed CDOs do we have? Well, maybe somewhere approaching $1 trillion of those, okay? Then we have the wonderful idea of synthetic CDOs, which is the idea that, okay, you only have so many asset-backed securities to pile into these CDOs, but you have these credit default swaps, which are basically bets, as described by Professor White, essentially bets taken on whether other bonds will default. So people started writing credit default swaps on mortgage-backed securities. And, of course, there's no limit to the number of bets you can write. You can write multiple bets on the same group of mortgages. It's perfectly fine. So Wall Street said, well, let's pack a whole bunch of credit default swaps on mortgage-backed securities, collateralized loan obligations, commercial mortgage-backed securities. And, hey, we can pool those. We can tranche those. We can create 80% AAA strips on synthetic CDOs and 15% mezzanines, and we can maybe do that over again. Nobody knows how many of these things there are, but I've seen numbers of there may be 5 to 6 trillion of synthetic CDOs out there. And, oh, by the way, there are another 50 trillion in nominal value, notional value of credit default swaps and index trades floating around, which are bets on something. A lot of them appear to be bets on mortgage-backed securities and other highly risky securitized entities. A lot of those bets were written by people like AIG. So the problem is, you know, the reason we've seen this catastrophe, you know, people say, well, how could it be that bad? There are only, you know, maybe 1.5 to 2 trillion of these highly risky mortgages. Even if half of those go bad, that's, you know, 750 billion. That's a lot of money, but I mean, these are enormous institutions. They could survive that, but not if there are multiple bets written on each one of these things. I mean, we're talking about bets in the multiples of trillions, it appears. No one really knows. That's part of the problem. Since no one really knew, everybody began to assume the worst. When the defaults started coming and, you know, and people started not being able to meet their obligations, then pretty soon people thought, okay, who can we trust? I mean, and so this is why the credit markets froze up. But part of the problem is, of course, that this is part of the story, that it was originated to not really distribute, because the underwriters of these mortgage-backed securities and CDOs actually couldn't sell all the stuff out. It takes a while to run this machine, and the loans and the CDOs in the warehouse for a while before you can sell them out. So when the music stopped, the biggest CDO and mortgage-backed securities underwriters were left with a lot of either undistributed strips or unsecuritized mortgages that they hadn't sold yet. In other cases, they got high on their own supply, as some people have said, because they thought, okay, you know, we can sell all the residuals. We can package up all the mezzanines into CDOs if we can. But AAAs, you know, there's only so much we can sell of those. But, hey, AAAs, we can hold those, and there are low capital requirements on those. We can make some yield. So people like UBS, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup began piling lots of AAA strips of CDOs and mortgage-backed securities on their own portfolio, again, until the music stopped. And then they thought, well, we can set up asset-backed commercial paper conduits and so-called SIVs, where basically we can say, okay, you buy up all this stuff and you issue commercial paper against what you're holding, and oh, by the way, if for some reason you can't roll over your commercial paper, we'll step in and give you a credit line to let you roll over your commercial paper. And, of course, again, when the music stopped, they couldn't roll over their commercial paper, and suddenly Citigroup and HSBC and a bunch of others had to take huge amounts of this stuff back on their balance sheets. Now, the question I have, of course, is, I mean, you know, why do we allow this to occur? Why did regulators allow it to occur? One question is, I mean, at every one of these large, you know, top 20 culprits that I've mentioned, there are resident examination teams, 24/7, 365. In fact, the regulators keep boasting, we're keeping an eye on these people. We're on site every day. What were they looking at? I mean, how could they not have seen this collective insanity? And then, of course, they said, oh, but we believe that, you know, in fact, we as regulators aren't really smart enough to figure out how risky these institutions are and how much capital they should be holding. So now we've adopted something called Basel II, which is, you know what, we regulators admit we're too stupid to figure out what you should be holding. So you tell us how much capital you should be holding. We're going to adopt an internal risk-based management philosophy where you tell us with your own internal risk-based management models how much capital you should be holding. Well, capital is very costly, and it's a prisoner's dilemma. If you hold more capital than the guy down the street, you can't produce the same return on equity that he can produce. So how many universal bank managers do you think were running into the Federal Reserve Board and the OCC and saying, you know what, we don't have enough capital. We need more. Well, a couple examples. The SEC adopted Basel II for the top five securities firms. They abandoned their old net capital rule. And pretty soon those top five firms had leverage ratios of 30 to 1 or more. The Europeans adopted Basel II before we did. And Deutsche Bank's and UBS's leverage ratios fell from about 9% to 3% under Basel II. Northern Rock, I mean, maybe you know, what a great name, Northern Rock, like the Rock of Gibraltar, I guess. That was the first big bank run in the UK. Well, they went to Basel II under the UK rules. And they boasted in the last public report they filed before they went bust. They said, we've adopted Basel II, and we're happy to tell you that we've cut our capital charges in half with Basel II. We're just delighted. I mean, Basel II is, it's again, insanity. I mean, the regulators just sort of saying, we don't know, you tell us. And all the incentives are for the institutions to have the minimum amount of capital possible. And Professor Willis mentioned that this wasn't all news to the regulators. In 2005, I just recently was looking at stuff, speeches, acting controller of the currency, Julie Williams, and then when the regular controller of the currency, John Dugan, came in, they were talking about, gee, we don't understand these negative amortization mortgages. We're worried about those because, after all, we've told the banks they can't have negative amortization credit cards anymore. That's too risky. And then Julie said, you know, and I'm really concerned that too many lenders are underwriting just to the teaser rates. You know, they're not underwriting to the fully amortized rates that are going to kick in, you know, after the teaser rate expires. But they didn't do anything. Okay, finally, in the middle of 2006, the federal regulators come out with so-called guidance, was it non-binding, no sanctions, no private right of actions, and the guidance proposed was, you know what, we think you should really underwrite to the fully amortized rate because it's not safe to underwrite the teaser rate. And the Mortgage Bankers Association marched in and said, you don't understand. If we have to underwrite to the fully amortized rate, we can't refinance these people, and they're all going to default. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, hasn't the Mortgage Bankers Association heard of the Fifth Amendment? Like, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to incriminate yourself. But they did on the record. They said, you don't understand. We can't refinance these people. They're going to all default. And I thought, you know, what an unbelievable situation. It took them 10 months to put the guidance into place in the middle of 2007, at which point, you know, all the horses were dead. They weren't out of the barn. They were dead in the field at that point. And then finally in 2008, the Fed adopts Homeowners Equity Protection Act rules saying, now, as a matter of civil sanction and private rights of action, you may not underwrite mortgages except at the fully amortized rate. I mean, what do the regulators need to know? I mean, these were toxic, exploding, shoot the victims type mortgages, and they knew it, and they allowed it to happen. Now, there's an obviously, to me, a real story of regulatory capture here. But, you know, I agree very much with my co-panelists that we need to deconstruct this story. And one of the things that occurs to me is that this story has a lot in common with the story of the 1920s, which is the last time we allowed the commercial banks to get deeply into bed with Wall Street. And actually, we had a warning, which was the dot-com telecom boom and bust with all the corrupt financial analysis and all the corrupt IPOs, which were brought to you by the same list of culprits I've just named. And we didn't seem to learn anything from the dot-com telecom boom and bust, which destroyed a lot of wealth and might have encouraged Chairman Greenspan to bring the interest rates down really low so we could move the housing market up to make up for the stock market that had just blown up. Well, now we've blown up both the stock market and the housing market, which is what happened in the 1920s to us and happened to Japan in the 1990s, and it took a decade in each case for both countries to get up off the floor. I would hope we might actually learn something from history for once and say, is this really the mentality we want driving the decisions of the institutions that collect all the savings of all the people and then deploy them? I hope we don't have a repetition of this. It's one of the saddest chapters in our financial history. Thank you.
Well, I think we have some time for Q&A. So, Gene, go ahead. Or Mike, go ahead. Could you please use the mic because of the recording?
So I guess I have a sort of a general question and a more specific question. So I guess this sort of follows up on Professor Wilmoth's claims. I mean, the whole tenor of the panel, except for Mr. Redleaf, seems to be placing blame on you know, the private sector.
No, I didn't place. Sorry.
Well, No, you did not. I was thinking of you as a.
Okay, moderator. I'm a moderator, not a member. Okay.
I know you, Tom.
All right.
I would never think that you would. No. And I guess I'm from my perspective, it's a very complicated thing going on. The more you examine it, you see government failure, you see private failure. And it's just very odd to me to say, well, when we see these regulatory failures, well, they were bought and captured, as opposed to just being regulatory failures. And when private failures happen because they're responding to bad regulatory incentives, that's private failures, right? So I guess my first more general question is, isn't that a problem, thinking about it? Don't we want to sort of look at these things separately, have find where the private failures are, where the government failures are, tease them out? And I guess the second question really is, in trying to do this with the loans, I've said, well, about half of these mortgage-backed securities came through Fannie and Freddie. So do we have to figure out what's going on there? Well, there's a government failure problem there. They're buying up If the loans fail, they'll buy them up, right? Well, why did people buy them? Well, they were being guaranteed, in essence, by that. So the real question then becomes, what about the 50% that's going through the private companies where we have tranches and the like? And I guess I have a question about that is sort of, why do you think the private sector bought these things? Now, in sort of looking into it, part of the answer seems to be that our capital requirements, a regulatory aspect, if encouraged it. If you got a AAA rating, which the guarantee companies would give you, it made more sense to buy a mortgage-backed security of subprime than to buy traditional mortgages. Again, a regulatory failure. So, but I'm not sure how important that is to the whole story. So those are my two questions for everybody.
Shall I start? I'll start. I won't say too much. There's so much to be said. No, I think that you're right. I mean, I think that this is a combined regulatory and private sector failure. And I do think that there were a series of perverse incentives set up by regulation. One was giving the national statistic ratings organizations, you know, the big three, you know, the right to sort of put the stamp of approval. And people said, hey, if it's AAA from Standard & Poor's and Moody's or Fitch, it must be okay. I mean, because the government, you know, the government certifies these people. And I agree also with Professor Smith's point that, yes, there was pressure coming from Congress, you know, to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and to the banks to make more loans available to marginal people. Now, I believe that the private sector, you know, responded to that, but also said, you know what, if we can preempt all consumer protections, which the federal agencies did, essentially, and Congress helped them, if we can preempt all consumer protections and make these incredibly, in my view, abusive and predatory products where at the end of 2 or 3 years when the teaser rate runs out, you're going to have to refinance because you can't pay the higher rate. We know you can't pay it. So you're going to be stripped out with prepayment penalties on the way out, and you're going to be stripped out with new financing rates on the way in, new financing charges on the way in. And as long as your housing price keeps going up, we can run that mill 2 or 3 or 4 times, and then maybe if you default, okay, you default. You know, my view is the private sector responded with, you know, a series of bad products, the abusive mortgages, the structured finance securities, which made no sense and which they needed the ratings agencies to go along with them. So I implicate both sides equally. But I think that there were, part of the story is that you have a small number of incredibly powerful organizations that effectively, you know, I think we're able to sort of muscle regulators, too, from their side to get the regulators to do some things they wanted.
Yeah, let me just add a comment about the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, because it was clearly part of the problem that they had this very ambiguous private-public role. But I don't think it was the desire of Congress to have them fulfill the public role of providing liquidity and financing for the most marginal borrowers that got them in trouble. I think it was actually their private aspect where they were trying to seek yield for their shareholders. Because the fact is the GSEs were kind of late to the party in the subprime game. I mean, the definition of a subprime loan originally was a loan that would not be purchased by a GSE. That's what it was. That's why it was called subprime. And they didn't actually buy very many actual subprime mortgages. They bought a lot of the securities,
yeah,
the AAA securities. In particular, it's not clear to me that if they hadn't bought them, sovereign wealth funds and other people wouldn't have bought them. So I'm not sure to what extent you can say the GSEs were sort of a pivotal cause. But they did get very involved in buying subprime mortgage-backed securities, and they got credit for stimulating affordable housing by buying mortgage-backed securities from subprime lenders, which I think was ludicrous. And to me, the solution to that is to be clear about our definition of what we want the GSEs for. We need the GSEs. Right now, there would be no mortgages made in America if we did not have Fannie and Freddie. And we need to be lucid about that. The private label securitization market is dead in the water right now. If you get a mortgage today in 2009, it will be funded by Fannie or Freddie, as wobbly as they are. But they don't need to be 50, 60, 70% of the market, right? They really need to be dealing with the very low moderate income, the FHA loans, and the private market can securitize middle and upper income mortgages. And we ended up getting it exactly wrong, it seems to me, because our poorest, most vulnerable borrowers were getting loans through the private, you know, label securitized market, and middle and upper income people were getting the ones that were sort of more standardized and regulated by Fannie.
Understandable,
Freddie.
Right?
right, simplified, understandable, you know, underwriting was strictly defined, and we need to fix that. So I think we need to have Fannie and Freddie, they need to be a small piece of the market, and they need to be intently focused on their public role, and we need to let the market take care of the vast bulk of, you know, the sort of 40, the median income and up.
A couple comments. I mean, I think first you're right. A lot of the undergird of this is regulatory arbitrage with the rating agencies, and the rating agencies were government supported monopolies, and that was a horrible mistake. And it's also the rating agencies, it seemed to me, along with Alan Greenspan, deserve a level of culpability that sort of private that a lot of the other players don't. I mean, Wall Street is in the business of selling securities. Everybody knows that. The rating agencies were with their government supported monopoly position was a genuine breach of trust. One idea that I'm kind of playing with that I haven't you know fully formulated, but if a regulated regime is losing business to regulated regimes have a competitive advantage against unregulated regimes. So if they're losing extensive business to an unregulated regime, it's prima facie sort of evidence that there's something wrong with the regulated regime. So, for example, you know, drugs, the regulation of drugs in the United States works sort of passively well. People don't buy a lot of black market drugs in the U.S. Even though you know you can sort of talk about problems of you know. Approvals too slow or too fast, and all sorts of things, but you don't see sort of wholesale movement to a black market. You did when we were under the net capital rule. A lot of the calculations didn't make any sense. And too much was required for some things, and too much and too little for other things. And pretty much, even while it was in existence, it was a dead letter because everything moved to the offshore subsidiaries of those entities. One comment about the CDS market gets a bad name, I'm in favor of a clearinghouse and a certain amount of regulation for CDS, but the CDS market has actually functioned very well. We sort of joke that through all of September, October, November, it was the most active liquid thinnest bid-ask spreads of sort of any credit market. Joke is, you know, sort of the market in which no money changes hands, in which you might at the end is functioning perfectly well. The things that you actually have to pay for,
like your own clearinghouse certificates,
are problematic. But in fact, people were very worried about Lehman and the agencies, but the fact of the matter is, everybody, if you delivered a deliverable security against a CDS contract, you got paid. And if you settled for, you make technical objections to the settlement procedure and their auction price setting, but that market cleared and that market worked. There's not a whole, you know, so.
So I would say that I think that we all actually were quite critical of regulation. I'm sort of surprised that you said you thought we were being critical of the private sector and not regulators. I mean, certainly a huge problem is that the sort of pick your regulator issue, right, that the banks could change their charters, pick a charter, and it created a race to the bottom among the regulators. The regulators lost their spine just the same way the rating agencies did. It doesn't take very many bad apples to ruin the pot, right? You have one appraiser who's engaging in fraud, well, suddenly the value of the whole block goes up, right? You don't have to have very many incentives that are pushed in the wrong direction without any regulatory oversight to ruin the whole pot. People were certainly responding to the incentives that were set up by the regulators, and they were not good incentives.
You see, but your response, all the responses are all of the same. It's the businesses that drove the regulators to a race to the bottom. It's the businesses that took over. Professor White said, oh, well, you know, the GSEs, you know, the helping poor people part, they were okay on it. It's the profit-making side. Whereas the way I think about it is you create regulatory incentives and then businesses respond to them. And a lot of these bad things, the causation is going in the opposite direction, right? When we've got a bank institution that's got deposit insurance, it's not shocking that they're going to have the bad incentives. So who do we blame? Do we blame the bank institution? Well, maybe, but to me, the primary incentives are coming from the fact that we've insured them. But maybe that's just...
My only other comment is the 1920s have a lot of interesting parallels when there was no regulation. In other words, unfortunately, financial markets have a boom and bust, psychology. And I think regulation has to play a role in mitigating both booms and busts. In the 20s, when there was no regulation, a lot of the same things happened. I mean, I think both sides can bear some blame.
Hi. I wonder, a brief comment and then a question. I wonder how much blame we might put on politically connected folks who are in the middle of all this, like the people at Fannie and Freddie, who are making millions of dollars, and if they blow the whistle, the gravy train stops. So I wonder about that, and how do we change Fannie and Freddie so that doesn't happen anymore? But my basic question is this: where do we go from here? How do we clear this at this point? I mean, I'm going to be talking tomorrow on a panel, and I've been critical of the idea of allowing strip down of home mortgages in Chapter 13 bankruptcy. I think there are a lot of things that are very wrong about that concept, and I've also argued that we ought to have maybe some federal legislation saying it's against public policy to enforce a contract provision that prohibits a servicer from renegotiating a mortgage in a way that maximizes the value of the mortgage. That should just be against public policy. And that's an inherent flaw in the contract, and I don't think there's an obligation of contract issue there. But is that going to clear the market? Do we really need massive bankruptcy write-downs to clear the market? Do we just need a lot of foreclosures to clear the market? Do we need authority for the servicers to do the write-downs themselves and to negotiate them with some clear protection and clear, not just protection from liability, but authorization to do it by the voiding of the contract provisions that prohibit it? What do the panelists think? Where do we go from here to clean this up?
The question of authority to modify mortgages is something I've been looking at fairly closely. There are a lot of regulatory distortions that come from government policy. I mean, part of the reason those contracts are written the way they are is tax policy, mm-hmm. right? I mean, they are motivated largely by the desire that these securitization entities should be sufficiently passive that they not be subject to double taxation. Mm-hmm. So the point is that you want the IRS is telling these servicers, we don't want you buying mortgages in and out of the pool, reducing the principal, increasing the principal, because now you start to look more like a mutual fund or maybe even more like an investment firm, right?
We need to fix that, perhaps.
And so, Congress could probably fix that problem. On the question of bankruptcy strip downs, I find that a fascinating question. There's a lot of hoo-ha about potential moral hazard and so forth. But the fact is, right now, mortgages are being foreclosed at tremendous losses, and the bankruptcy strip down is simply a way to take a lot of that deadweight loss out of the process and write them down in a way where, rather than going through a process of kicking out one homeowner and finding somebody else whose ability to pay the loan under current economic circumstances isn't likely to be any much greater than the person you've kicked out, and hope that they will repay a new loan, and going through all those transaction costs, I mean, is ludicrous. And most of the strip-down proposals are to just deal with the existing pipeline of loans. I mean, I think the Durbin bill has already been amended in the last 2 days to do that, basically. So we're not talking about, you know, creating rights that are going to impact future granting of mortgages.
I know in Chapter 12 for family farmers had a sunset of a couple of years, too,
right.
And it's still on the books 30 years later.
So those are similar kinds of ideas. But the I mean, I'm with you on the idea that Congress could certainly pass a law that says, you know, provisions in pooling servicing agreements that prevent servicers from restructuring mortgages are hereby declared void. There's nothing that, I don't think that's a takings. I don't think that that creates substantive due process problems.
Yeah, and there has been language like that, actually, at the state level in California, as I'm sure you know, that was then rejected.
And there was a bill in Congress that would have prevented the servicers from being held liable, but it didn't actually grant them authority,
right,
which I thought was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
And one other thing is I do think that going through the bankruptcy process as it is currently set up also then creates a credible amount of waste, right? If all you're trying to do it, the only reason you're declaring bankruptcy is in order to get on top of your mortgage again, why go through the entire bankruptcy process?
Well, the Chapter 13, basically a five-year process.
Yeah.
You do five-year process, and you only get the strip down. Yeah.
The panel's talked a bit about problems with incentives. One thing which puzzles me is, in making a lot of these loans, it seems as though the incentives shouldn't really have been there to make the loans, because at a certain stage, it shouldn't have been that hard to see your end results weren't going to be that good. Professor Wehrmuth addressed this a little bit in terms of sort of the, you know, you make enough money, some of the time somebody doesn't pay, you've still come out ahead. But I may be wrong, but I don't think that covers all or even most of what we're talking about. Why didn't incentives just simply help avoid some of this fraud?
One of the most fascinating historical documents to me is the Examiner's Report in the New Century Financial, Chapter 11. New Century was an originator of subprime loans, right? And they got in trouble because of repurchase obligations. It became apparent that more and more of their loans were not only defaulting in the distant future, they were defaulting after the first month after they were made. I mean, so, you know, you talk about short-term thinking. And the fact is that in spite of the fact that every month top management at New Century was getting reports saying, look, our loans are having higher and higher early payment defaults and first payment defaults to the point where we're going to have to repurchase them all from these securitizations, so this whole originate to distribute is going to break down because we're going to have to buy them all back. They nevertheless continued to underwrite the way they underwrite, and basically they just did it until the whole thing fell apart. I think there's some fascinating research to do about the sort of the behavioral economics of that. It's like, why would a company engage in such irrational, I mean, clearly irrational in the long term, and even irrational sometimes in the medium and almost short term behavior? I think part of it is inertia. They have this culture that this is how they made money last year, so they just can't accept the fact that they can't make money that way this year. But I think it's a fascinating question. But it clearly happened, right? I mean, that's one of the challenges as sort of a professional lawyer and amateur economist is, right, like, these things are irrational, and we observe that they happen. Why? But clearly they happen.
Yeah, I think that there, you know, there is this behavioral psychological question, and there seems to, you know, in some of these organizations, many of them, sort of a herd mentality takes over where they adopt a culture, and, you know, if you're a team player, this is the way we do it. Now, I think part of it was that real estate prices were skyrocketing, you know, from about 2003 to 2006. And I think a lot of people thought, well, you know, even if you know, and then you see stories where people would say, well, you know, I can't pay anything other than this introductory teaser rate, so I don't know how I'm going to keep paying this mortgage. And the broker or the lending officer would come back and say, don't worry, we'll refinance you, because by that time the housing price will be up and we can refinance you at a higher amount if we have to. So there was some feeling that, you know, even if there was doubt about ability to make payments, they could refinance, because, and if they couldn't refinance, they could foreclose and they could still get the value of the house out, because the price kept going up. And of course, the problem was that in the middle of 2006, suddenly the prices stopped going up. And then as soon as they stopped going up, then everything began to hit the fan, because you got all these early defaults and suddenly foreclosures began to be costly and refinances were impossible. And then there was a panic the other way. Then everybody starts to, a lot of speculators, of course, bought houses on these subprime option ARMs. People start trying to dump their houses and get out. And then, of course, you know, it goes the other way. So there does seem to be sort of a euphoric panic, you know, sort of oscillation here. And it's interesting. I mean, Hyman Minsky, who was sort of viewed as an absolute crackpot, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, suddenly Hyman Minsky from the grave is considered kind of a prophet of, you know, sort of how modern capitalist finance tends to go through these different stages and eventually reach kind of a Ponzi stage. Bernard Madoff, I guess, you know, verifies that. And eventually the Ponzi stage, you know, breaks down and people realize it's a Ponzi stage. But it's a very interesting question. I think there's going to be a lot of, as I say, deconstruction to be done to understand why really brilliant people, or at least people who are pretty smart, would have gotten involved in such a musical chairs game that they must have, you would have thought they would have known, wouldn't last for all that long.
One of the things that I think going on is kind of as a result of, you know, what's often called Bretton Woods II and the U.S. chronic trade deficit and no sort of countervailing mechanism, the we shipping dollars overseas, they're sending, you know, toys and so forth, and government agencies have that created more demand for very high grade fixed income securities than exist in nature. You know, sort of more sort of AAA treasury type securities than exist in nature, and so they had to be created, and in fact you can sort of always, you know, you can divide B collateral into A and C collateral. It's hard to do that at a net gain and pay everybody at the table, but we could generate
more paper,
an infinite amount of B collateral from which to manufacture
the CDOs, the
top tier for which there was more demand, and a lot of those players were non-economic players, so. Yeah. So you don't really have to ask, you know, why is the Bank of China buying AAA mortgage-backed securities based on, you know,
on yield, right?
On yield, and you know, because they have macroeconomic policy constraints objectives and so one of the interesting questions is exactly how much of those securities was bought by non-economic players, and then when you have non-economic players and you have faith in markets, you get a kind of self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
There's a critical mass of non-economic players that will set prices and pass the people that will go along.
Well, we're past 8:30 now, so I think I'll call it a stop. Thank you very much.